Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. I'm really happy you've tuned in today on this July 13th, 2018. And I'm happy to welcome two guests to the program today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Allison O'Kell. And we've also got Dr. Mark Atkinson. He is a diabetes researcher. She is a veterinarian. And we're going to be talking today about diabetes. And we're going to learn whether dogs can teach people about ways to treat diabetes, a condition which affects many people and many pets as well. We're going to take your phone calls as well, 352-392-8989. Animal Airwaves Live is coming up after this news from NPR. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. Really happy you've tuned in today on this Friday, the 13th of July, 2018. And I'm happy to welcome today to the program two guests. And a conversation that we're going to have today is going to be really fascinating. And I'm glad that I have both of them here because they each are going to talk about two kind of aspects of the same kind of condition. And we're going to find out a lot more about that when I talk right now to Allison O'Kell and Mark Atkinson. And I'm grateful to both of you for being here. Our topic today is diabetes. And in particular, we're going to talk about the ways that perhaps the treatment of diabetes in dogs can inform the treatment of diabetes in human beings, and maybe vice versa as well. So again, thank you both for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
And thank you. Agree.
Maybe let's sort of start with the most fundamental question, which is, what is diabetes? Is it sort of one monolithic thing, or is it kind of a multifaceted thing, sort of the way that cancer is a multifaceted thing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And diabetes is definitely multifaceted. So there are several different types of diabetes, both in people and in animals. So most people have probably heard of type 1 or type 2 diabetes in people. And in our pets, such as dogs and cats, which are the pets that we would most commonly think of having diabetes, we also have several different types of diabetes. I'm going to pass it on to Dr. Mark Atkinson, who's a human diabetes researcher, to talk a little bit more about type 1 versus type 2 in people. And then we can, I think, would be informative to compare that to what we see in dogs and cats.
Right. Thank you, Allison. So it is interesting, as Alan says, that in terms of diabetes, most people think of type 1 or type 2 because in the United States, there are about 30 million people that are thought to have diabetes in some way, shape, or form. And most of the attention goes to type 1 or type 2. But in reality, if you look at the number of syndromes that are associated with it, we believe there are at least 28 different types of diabetes that can occur. And they will handle not only type 1 or type 2 diabetes, but also efforts such as gestational diabetes, as well as what's called MODY, or monogenic diabetes of youth, and many other, and they have complex words, but what are called monogenic diabetes. So there's many ways that one can develop diabetes. But the key thing is they all have in common the notion that your blood glucose levels are too high. And that's the key thing here to recognize, from whether or not you're talking about canines, felines, or humans, is that blood glucose levels are too high, usually due to defects in either the pancreas and the insulin-producing cells or the other tissues that will process glucose as fuel. And so there's a gamut of different ways that one can develop diabetes. And as you said, Dana, in the opening notion, our goal here at the University of Florida in terms of research effort is to try and do something very novel. And I think it's very novel in terms of trying to let what we have learned in canine situations or feline situations guide us in our understanding of humans. In that for many, many years, we've relied on rodent models, meaning mice and rats, in terms of trying to figure out what develops diabetes. And Dr. O'Kell is leading an effort that I think is very innovative and stands well for the University of Florida in terms of her belief that if we study canine diabetes, we will make major inroads into better understanding the disease in humans.
So if we can say that just as a whole, diabetes is a condition of elevated blood glucose, maybe it would be helpful to understand exactly the purpose that glucose serves in the blood to begin with. Because here's something that, you know, you can say the blood sugar is too high, but I don't exactly know what that means and what is an acceptable level and what makes it too high.
Sure, that's a great question and really important to understand about diabetes. So blood sugar or glucose is the more technical term for sugar, is really important for life. And glucose is needed by all cells in the body for energy and for life. And so your body has a very specific regulating system for blood glucose. And the pancreas is an organ that's in your abdomen, in a dog, a cat, et cetera. That has hormones that are released to regulate that glucose. One of those important hormones is insulin. And in diabetes, the pancreas is either not producing enough of that insulin to regulate the blood sugar, or that insulin is not being secreted properly, or the body cannot respond to it. And those different defects in insulin are characteristic of different types of diabetes. But overall, your blood sugar is regulated by insulin as one of the most important hormones. So when your blood sugar is increasing, insulin is secreted, and that insulin allows your cells to take up glucose. So what we want is glucose to go from your bloodstream into your cells to give your cells energy. When we don't have enough insulin, the blood sugar is kind of stuck in your bloodstream. It can't go into those cells, making the sugar in your blood really high. And so that can cause a whole bunch of complications. It causes the clinical signs that we see when we think about diabetes, and that is drinking a lot of water, urinating a lot, losing weight. And that's all because your body is not able to get that energy from the glucose. And that glucose that's really high in your blood, it actually spills over into your urine. And because the glucose also pulls water with it, water likes to kind of stick to glucose, it makes your urine volume really high. So you drink a lot, you pee a lot, and you lose weight because your body can't use that glucose. A normal level of glucose in the body is somewhere between 80 to 120 milligrams per deciliter. That's just sort of what we'd see on a blood panel. It's pretty similar between dogs and cats and people. And so the body strives to keep the sugar in that range. With diabetes, it's not able to do that because of the lack of insulin.
So in dogs and people, maybe in most mammals as well, the function's basically the same in terms of the insulin and the glucose and the pancreas?
Yeah, essentially the basic physiology is very similar. There are subtle differences, but overall, as a whole, yes, it's the same.
So any human being who – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's interesting. And again, Allison is totally spot on. But if we're talking about all animals here, it is kind of interesting because as we when I say we, I mean more people that are interested in animals look across species and they look at rodents or bears and other things, other animals that hibernate. It's interesting how the body on different species will adapt to situations and try and control metabolism, which is this process that we're talking about. Meaning if you go through periods of hibernation, in certain species, they have the ability to turn on or turn off these processes that Allison was talking about, which is very elegant. But in terms of humans, and again, I'm not going to take away from Animal Airways, we are in a little bit of a unique experiment here, evolutionarily. meaning that for much of history, people have been in a feast famine situation, meaning that they, you know, the ability to obtain food is not a sure thing. But now we are in a situation where essentially, you know, 24/7, 365, you have food at your disposal.
Very so, energy rich food. I mean, like.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we part of the diabetes epidemic in the United States and globally has to do with the ability to have food when you want, what you want, and in different constituencies. And again, this may relate back to Allison in terms of seeing, if you look at the rates of rise of diabetes in humans, they correlate to what's happening in canines. Right.
Well, so we think of diabetes in human beings as being a very significant problem, and I think that you mentioned that it's millions of human beings in the United States. But Dr. O'Kell, you were saying that the rate in dogs is not necessarily as high a percentage as it is in human beings.
It may not be as high of a percentage, but the rate is definitely increasing with time. And several studies have come out in the last 20 years, and the most recent one was done by a very large corporation of pet hospitals in the country and looked at the prevalence of this disease and found that in dogs, it's definitely increasing about 80% over since 2006. So that's a huge increase. And we think about diabetes as actually being one of the most common endocrine diseases in dogs, the endocrine system being the gland, so the pancreas, the thyroid, the adrenal glands. So while we say we think that about 0.25% of dogs have diabetes, it sounds like a very small amount, but that actually is it's a fairly common disease that we see. In cats, diabetes overall is a little bit more common in cats than in dogs, so we're looking at more like 0.7% of cats. Again, it seems very small, but that is pretty significant for us. And the rate of diabetes in cats is going up a little bit, but not as fast as the rate of diabetes in dogs, which is interesting.
Well, what you were saying in dogs, 80% over what, about a decade?
Yeah, a little over a decade.
That's an astounding increase, and surely there must be something that scientists are pointing to as potential cause for such a rapid increase in such a short amount of time?
You know, I wish we knew. I think we also have to keep in mind that with time, pet care and veterinary care is becoming better. And also people may be more likely, I think, over time to take their animals to a veterinarian. I think with time, pets are being seen more as a member of our families and people are willing to invest in their health care. So I think with time, part of it may be that more dogs are going to the vet when they're sick. I think we don't know how much of a factor that plays. So some of that rise could be just because dogs always had diabetes, but now we're just diagnosing it more and more of them are going to the vet. I do think there's probably some other factor involved. We don't know what that is. A lot of blame wants to go on to obesity because the rate of obesity in pets is also rising. But in dogs, we actually don't have a strong link with the research that's been done that obesity causes diabetes. We think that it can contribute to poor control of their diabetes. Actually, we know that. But an actual cause of, yes, this is obesity causing this, we don't know that. There's what we call a correlation. So obesity is rising and diabetes is rising. But are those two rising independently of each other or is one related to the other? We don't know.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill, and my guests today are Dr. Allison O'Kell and Dr. Mark Atkinson. And we're going to take a short break, and we're going to be back with more of the program right after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today, Dr. Allison O'Kell and Dr. Mark Atkinson. And we're talking today about diabetes, not just in animals, but also in people. And when we left off, we had sort of explained kind of what diabetes is and how it's similar in dogs and human beings. And we talked a bit about how it is on the rise, especially in dogs, though that could be partly, as Dr. O'Kell was explaining, due to the fact that I think animals are getting better veterinary care. Before we move on, Dr. Atkinson, in addition to certainly an increase in obesity, which could be a contributing factor to diabetes in human beings, is it possible that the medical care that people are getting, or sort of the rates of detection, are going up in people that could contribute to a rise in incidence of diabetes?
Right. That's a great question. And that's something that we've been looking at, meaning for much of our history in terms of medicine, we have at an international level been more focused on communicable diseases, which means, if I could say, infectious diseases, meaning most attention internationally has been on things like HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, those type of disorders, and things like cancer and diabetes, whereas they've been given attention, they have kind of been on the outside, or because in terms of an immediate need, they're just not seen as being much of importance. Maybe 2 hours ago, I emailed somebody and I said, diabetes is the Rodney Dangerfield of diabetes. And depending on your age, you may not know what I'm talking about.
It doesn't
about,
get respect.
Yeah, it doesn't get respect. And diabetes just doesn't get respect. But yet, in humans, and again, Allison can speak to dogs, this is a top five cause of death in the United States and globally. But for whatever reasons, it's just not given respect. And we think and hope that as efforts are make progress in communicable diseases to prevent them, that maybe more and more attention will be given to diabetes. Because I certainly know in animals, this is a big deal.
And not just in terms of mortality, which in and of itself is significant and really tragic for those individuals who are affected by it, but it is a real life-limiting disease in terms of quality of life. I mean, mm-hmm. if we're talking about the way that diabetes is treated right now, and if it is a deficit of insulin, the solution for many, and this might be true for dogs as well as human beings, is insulin injections or somehow getting more insulin into the body. But this means checking the blood sugar regularly, which is burdensome in and of itself, and then dealing with, for many people, injections of insulin, which is uncomfortable. It can be expensive. It's time consuming. And you've got to be really vigilant about it, lest you allow yourself to experience too great a rise in blood sugar because you weren't monitoring it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And certainly for our animal patients, that's one of our primary concerns as veterinarians when we do treat diabetes or talk to people when their pet gets diagnosed with diabetes, because it is a big deal for this owner, for their whole lifestyle. Because in dogs, we expect that most cases will require insulin injections for life. There are very few cases that their diabetes would what we call go into remission or not require insulin anymore. Cats are a little bit different, where they do typically require insulin injections initially. A reasonable percentage of them might actually go into remission and no longer require insulin injections. And some of those can be managed for quite a while with just some other management, such as diet and keeping the weight down. Others will require insulin injections throughout life. But overall, it is a commitment, because that animal is going to require usually twice a day injections at approximately the same interval and close monitoring for high blood sugar, but also low blood sugar or hypoglycemia, because that actually can be more severe and can even cause death. And so it's a big deal that the owner really needs to take into account. And we often stress that it's a manageable disease, but you have to be committed to it.
And not to take anything away from the effect that it has on human beings who suffer from this condition, but when you think about the commitment, as you said, Dr. O'Kell, of handling a pet that has this, it means for the pet owner, probably every day waking up, immediately taking care of your animal's diabetes, like an injection, going to work, and then you have to come home, right? Like you can't just have a night on the town. You can't go away for the weekend without thinking about, having this taken care of. So it means whoever is pet sitting for you has got to be comfortable with giving an injection. That's a whole extra level of responsibility. When some of us who have cats, for example, are used to being able to, I go away for a day or two, it's no big deal. I come back and, there's still a little bit of food left in the bowl and there's plenty of water.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a consideration for sure, because schedules have to be fairly similar. And you're right, you can't just go away. You need to have someone that's going to be able to do this treatment and do it properly, or else you do risk your pet getting sick. I think there are some tools that they use in human medicine that are becoming a little bit more common when we monitor diabetes in dogs and cats, but we're certainly not to the level that they use in people. So people will often wear a glucose monitor all the time. They will have insulin pumps that will give them insulin along with sometimes they'll give a different insulin as an injection. We're not quite there yet in animals, but there are some continuous glucose monitors, which is something that you would put on your dog. Sort of it's a device that you stick onto your dog and measures the glucose sort of all the time for about 10 days. That's not something that we do, continuously, but that can help with some of the management. So we are seeing those devices that they're using in people start to come into our veterinary world a little bit, and I think some of that will help with management. However, it does not change the fact that we're still going to be responsible for maintaining that insulin in that pet, and they're dependent on you.
You know, one of the things I'd like Allison to talk about here a little bit is about, and it does relate back to diabetes in humans versus dogs, meaning 2 points. One, for those in the audience that are looking at this, there is a species or dog breed, I guess you'd say, notion here, meaning there are some breeds of dogs that have a very high incidence of diabetes, and then some that essentially rarely, if ever, develop diabetes. For example, I have two dogs. One of mine is a golden retriever. The number of diabetes cases in golden retriever are essentially non-existent, meaning they are incredibly resistant to diabetes. And so for those that are on the call that hear about those. But then there are other breeds that are really high. So breed means something in terms of this disease. So Allison, do you want to talk about
that? Yeah, absolutely. So when you have a dog of any sort of purebred, they often have a list of conditions that they're predisposed to. And we think that's likely due to genetics and inbreeding. And diabetes is the same way. And so we have high-risk breeds. So some examples, and this is not an exhaustive list because it's pretty long, but Samoyeds are one of the most common breeds that comes up in many studies. They're not really much of a Florida breed, if anyone knows what a Samoyed is, but there are some around. Some of the terrier breeds, such as Karen Terriers, Tibetan Terriers, Schnauzers, like miniature and standard Schnauzers, pugs, Bichons, Siberian Huskies, Yorkshire Terriers. There's a whole list of dogs that come up in these studies as being really more common than others. Other breeds, such as the Golden Retriever, as Dr. Atkinson said, as well as Boxers and German Shepherds, don't seem to get diabetes very often. And so it is something to think about. Whenever you are getting a dog, you need to be aware that some dogs are going to be at high risk for diseases than others. because, though, that the as we talked about, that prevalence of the disease is not high overall, you know, it's not something that I'd say should stop you from getting a dog, but you need to be aware of the health risk factors for a pet when you're picking one out. Also, though, mixed breed dogs can get diabetes, and so it's just because you have a mixed breed, unfortunately, mm-hmm. does not protect you from that.
You anticipated my question. Now, for anyone who is affected by diabetes, be it man or beast, whether or not the rates are high amongst any particular breeds is irrelevant. What matters to that person or animal is that it affects that individual, and therefore it is a troubling condition. It is also probably an economically significant condition. I imagine that the treatment, both for pets and people, is not without a significant cost.
All right. So, again, I know we're on animal airwaves, and I want to be really respectful here, meaning for both animals and humans, this is a national catastrophe. There's been data that, again, as I mentioned earlier, about 30 million Americans have some form of diabetes, and probably about 30 to 33% of them don't have consistent insurance in order to be able to provide for the care necessary to maintain their health care. And again, I know it's animal airways, but I'm going to say about a third of all kidney transplants in the United States occur with individuals with diabetes. The leading cause of blindness in adults with diabetes in the United States is for people with diabetes. The number of cases of where amputations occur, the largest number of amputations that occur in non-traumatic situations are for those with diabetes, with an average cost of about $84,000. It is a travesty. And yeah. We, as a nation, have to come up with a way to pay for this. And this leads to actually why we think the University of Florida, in our efforts, Allison, with the College of Veterinary Medicine, and ours in the College of Medicine, could really be innovative here, meaning we are trying, and that's what was in your efforts moving forward. We want to understand diabetes in canines, and maybe felines, but more canines, better to try and avert this noxious situation in humans, which we can't handle.
And a little bit later in the program, we're definitely going to tell some folks how they can perhaps get involved, those who have pets that might be affected. But before we sort of transition, you know, when we think about the state of healthcare for human beings in the United States, and I think that we can all agree that it isn't what it ought to be. And though individuals who have diabetes certainly should do their very best to care for themselves and make sure that they're keeping their diabetes under control, it is often beyond the means of some people to really handle the problem. And then with pets, you add to that the fact that the pet insurance, while it exists, is very rare. So, you know, human beings maybe have insurance and might be able to get it covered in many instances. But if it's affecting your animal, most people are probably going to be coming out of pocket.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It is not a cheap disease to treat, for sure, because you do have to have the cost of the diagnosis, first of all, which, you know, involves your veterinarian and some testing to do that. And then you will be buying insulin syringes and needles to give those injections. And then there's also regular monitoring to make sure that our treatment is effective, make sure we don't need changes in doses, as well as to monitor for complications. And so that all can be very expensive. And you're right that not a lot of people have pet insurance, though I do think it is becoming more common to have that. I can't really speak to, you know, there's a lot of pet insurance out there. you know, do they cover diabetes? I can't speak to that. You'd have to look into that specifically. But I do always think it's a good idea for people to think about pet insurance, especially when you have a young, healthy animal before they develop conditions that may be excluded, or have some sort of a pet fund where every month you put money away into a bank account so that if you have a condition or an emergency, you have the money to pay for that, and you don't have to be scrambling or, you know, worse, making tough decisions that you, because you are not able to afford treatment.
So, Allison, I'm wondering if you could do the listeners a favor and walk through a diagnosis of diabetes in an animal, meaning what would you say, what do you instruct them to do, and how this walks through, because I think it might be of interest to people.
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, you probably would notice in your pet that the signs of diabetes before it was diagnosed, because the majority do get diagnosed because they have these signs. We aren't able to diagnose them early yet. We're hoping to do that, but I'll talk a little bit about that later. So they're probably going to be drinking a lot of water, urinating a lot, and losing weight. And so your veterinarian is going to hear that, and diabetes is going to be one of the thoughts that crosses their mind out of a list of multiple conditions that could cause that. So your animal will likely get blood work, and that will show that your dog or cat's blood sugar is very high, and then a urine sample will show that there's also sugar glucose in the urine. And that, combined with those clinical signs, is usually enough to make a diagnosis of diabetes. In some cases, they may want to do a follow-up sample, and especially if the presence of those signs is questionable. But in general, that's how we would diagnose that. And then we would recommend starting insulin treatment. And there are many different types of insulin. We don't have time to go into all of them, but there are some that are specifically approved for dogs and cats. One of them is called Vetsulin. And then there are also human variety insulins that are used in people that we also can use in pets. And so you, along with your veterinarian, would choose one of those insulins, and then we would instruct the pet owner on how to give that injection. So we would go over everything from how do you mix the bottle of insulin properly, how do you draw that insulin into a syringe. We'll probably have you practice giving injections on a stuffed animal or a piece of fruit or something so that you are comfortable doing that. And then we'll have you show us how you can give an injection to your pet, because not getting the insulin into the pet is one of the causes of poorly regulated diabetes that we always look at. And so it's really important that we teach you how to do that properly. And so once you're comfortable there, we'll recommend a schedule of insulin, usually twice a day for most pets and for most types of insulin. Occasionally we can do once a day, but that would be the less common situation. And then you would go home and you have a couple of days where you're probably going to struggle with it a little bit. But then in a week or two, we have you back and we check your pet's blood sugar, usually every couple of hours, and we kind of see how the control is doing. So that would be sort of a day in the life of your first week as a diabetic pet owner. And it's certainly not, it's not impossible. Some people really struggle at first with injections, but they really can learn how to do it. And, you know, I think it's not as daunting as it seems at first. So most people are willing to give it a try and are successful at the treatment.
Thank you for that explanation. We've got a caller on the line, and maybe just before we go to a break, Glenn, can we quickly get to the phone call? Yeah, let's go talk to Joshua. Has a question about what's common between breeds. Go ahead, Joshua. Thanks for joining the program.
Hi, thank you very much. I was wondering if the possibilities to why certain breeds have a resistance to type 1 have been explored, and if those are applicable in a clinical setting.
Thank you so much for the question. Tune into your radio right now as we discuss it. Thank you very much for the call.
Hi, thank you, Joshua, for the question. That's a great question. So the fact that we have breed predisposition certainly suggests there's a genetic component to diabetes in dogs. And this has not been explored nearly as much as it has been in people. But what we do know is that within breeds that are high risk for diabetes, there's a type of genetic marker. It's called DLA, or dog leukocyte antigen. And that is a marker that's present in all dogs, but there are different forms of that marker that occur in different breeds, and they're passed down from mother and father to offspring in different ways. And so there is some thought that that marker could be related to the risk for diabetes. There are also some other genetic markers involved in genes related to the immune system that have also been linked to diabetes in dogs. However, the fact that we have these different dog breeds actually makes it a little bit tricky, because these markers are common in, say, the Samoyed. What we don't know is, in a Samoyed with diabetes, does that marker just tell us that the dog is a Samoyed and that's why the risk is high, or does a Samoyed with that marker have a higher risk than a Samoyed without that marker? It's a little bit hard to explain, but in sort of just as an overall, we have an idea that there are genetic markers, but that hasn't really been fully sorted out because we haven't been able to do large enough studies. I do have some colleagues in the United Kingdom who are working a lot on genetics of diabetes in dogs, and I'm hoping that they're going to come out with some new sort of research in that area. That DLA is actually similar to one of the genetic risks for type 1 diabetes in people, which is HLA. Or human leukocyte antigen, and that is a known risk factor. If you have certain forms of that HLA in people, you're at higher risk for type 1 diabetes. So that's one area where the two intersect, and where we've done research in dogs that looks like we may have similarities there to people. We just need to sort that out a bit further.
And Dr. Atkinson, I know you want to add something, but we're late for a break. Can I get you to tell us as soon as we come back?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. I want to remind listeners, this is Animal Airwaves Live. My guests are Dr. Allison O'Kell and Dr. Mark Atkinson. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with more right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill. So glad you've tuned in on this Friday. And I'm happy to have two guests this afternoon, Dr. Allison O'Kell and Dr. Mark Atkinson. And we're talking today about diabetes and how studying diabetes in dogs may help people and vice versa. And Dr. Atkinson, before we took this break, I kind of cut you off, but you were gonna add something.
And I'm perfectly happy with being cut off. But what I wanted to bring forward was the notion that we as taxpayers paid for over a decade an effort was called the Human Genome Project, where a series of efforts were put together by researchers to develop ways to sequence DNA and essentially determine the genome. And it was an amazing effort, but it paid off in terms of technology-wise. To try and sequence the genomes of everything from bees to dogs to cats. Many different organisms have now had their genome sequenced. And in terms of dogs, it was interesting because people looked at the genomes of a series of dogs, I think, and I'll put this think, 150 different species of dogs last year, and tried to develop a map of where dog breeds developed and how they were bred over time to form the common breeds that we have now and where their origins were. And I believe it's possible that over time, and again, it's premature to say, but it could be that we're going to find insights, and I'll kick this back to Allison, that over time we're going to, again, be able to explain through understanding genetics the associations we see with breeds like Samoyeds that were mentioned, where they 15% of Samoyeds will develop diabetes, whereas, as I noted, in Golden Retrievers, they don't develop diabetes. So hopefully this will be combined human genetics and dog genetics, where we'll be able to again, understand the risk for developing diabetes. Allison, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important, and it may even be that diabetes in different dog breeds is a little different. So maybe diabetes in your miniature Schnauzer is different than in your Samoyed or in your Yorkshire Terrier, and genetics may play a role in that. We don't have large enough studies on each breed yet to fully sort that out, but I think as more emphasis comes on to studying diabetes and genetics, hopefully in the future, some of those questions will be answered.
What role do our large national sort of health institutions like NIH or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention play in maybe looking at the utility of studying diabetes in animals as a way to understand diabetes in people?
Yeah, that's a great question. And certainly those agencies do fund science and through grants. And there certainly are many grants out there studying or looking at human diabetes. Some of those involve different animal models of diabetes, one of the most common being rodent models, as Dr. Atkinson mentioned earlier in the program. But we're also, you know, in the sense of looking at a dog or a cat, and in my case, a dog, as can we learn about diabetes in people from dogs and vice versa? And they're actually interested somewhat in that question. And recently I received funding from a federal agency, from the National Institutes of Health, to study questions about diabetes in dogs and how we can compare dogs to people. And what we're hoping is that what we learn about dogs through these studies will, for one, help dogs, of course, but also be able to be translated to people. And maybe we can develop therapies that work in dogs that can be used in people eventually, and vice versa. So that's sort of the overall goal. So there is interest from some of the funding agencies into this question. And sort of the next, I think, few years, we'll try to investigate that and see what we can find.
Well, so what's the next step for you? I mean, in order to determine the answer to that question, what do you need in your research into dogs? What would be helpful?
Sure. Yeah. So I just opened sort of three studies that are going to be over about a 5-year time period. And so what I'm going to look at is, for one, we're going to look at dogs that have been diagnosed with diabetes pretty recently, so within about 2 to 4 weeks. And I'm going to follow them over time, and we're going to look at some different markers in their blood related to metabolism and the immune system. And we're going to see if we can look at changes in those markers. We're calling them biomarkers, to see if we can get insight into whether the immune system plays a role, what areas in the metabolic system play a role, and can that help tell us really why these dogs are getting diabetes? Because that's overall the question. We don't know really the cause in most cases, and knowing that will really help us define better prevention and treatment. I'm also starting a study to try and determine risk factors in those high-risk dog breeds that I was talking about. So there's a long list of them, but we're going to follow those dogs over time, and we're going to look at their blood, and we're going to look for markers in dogs that do become diabetic, compare those to non-diabetic dogs, and we're going to see if we can get an idea of, are there markers in the blood that can predict the risk of diabetes in dogs? So the overall question being, can we detect this disease earlier? In people with type 1 diabetes, they can detect antibodies in their blood. So that's an antibody is produced by your immune system, and it's an indication that your immune system is reacting to something in your body. In people, it's reacting to something that it shouldn't. So things like insulin, your body can produce this antibody to insulin, and that can be a risk factor for diabetes in people. In dogs, we're not as sure whether those markers exist and really what their significance is. So we're trying to look for markers that can help tell us who's at risk for diabetes so that we can try to predict that as early as we do in people. So overall, we're trying to you know, really get an idea of what markers can we find to diagnose diabetes early or that can inform us about why dogs get diabetes and how similar that disease is to that in people.
We've only got about 2 minutes left, Dr. Atkinson. You wanted to add something, but I'd sort of also like to ask, I mean, are you both optimistic that the results will be positive and that we'll see improvement in the treatment of diabetes in dogs and people?
Yeah. Oh, I am, and I want to save time for Allison. But if you look in the face of a dog, I mean, they're dependent on us. They are. And we are gaining all of this knowledge about diabetes in humans. Why would we not try and use that knowledge in humans for dogs? And then at the same time, might there be the possibility that something we could learn from dogs would, you know, pay it forward and go back toward humans? I believe it. Allison believes it. And we think at UF, we're kind of on the cutting edge here in terms of seeing that move forward. Allison?
Yeah, I think we have some really exciting studies to look at this. I think, we're still... It's going to take time, as all good research does, to really sort of come to a conclusion about the findings. But I do think that in many diseases, dogs do have similarities to people, and therapies that we use in dogs have helped dogs and people. And so I think there is the potential for that in diabetes as well. So I'm really excited about what we're doing and hoping that we can help both dogs and people. If anyone is interested in helping out with this, any of these research studies, because we do need diabetic dogs as well as healthy control dogs to kind of compare, there is a clinical research website that you can find on the College of Veterinary Medicine. If you just search for College of Veterinary Medicine at UF Clinical Trials, you'll find information about it. Feel free to reach out, because any help that we can get with this effort would be much appreciated.
Well, Dr. Allison O'Kell and Dr. Mark Atkinson, thank you both so much for being here. I learned a whole lot today. I hope our listeners did too. Thank you to Glenn Richard for directing the program. And thank you for those of you who listen. I hope you'll join me again next week for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.